My name is Connie Evans. I'm 48 years old. Today's date is May 28th, 2009. We are at Griffin Hospital in the Center for Cancer Care, and I'm interviewing Paul Nussbaum, who is my colleague here at Griffin.
Okay, my name is Paul Nussbaum. I didn't know I was going to have to tell my age, but I'm 62. Today is May 28th, 2009. We're here at the Griffin Hospital Center for Cancer Care. And I'm with Connie Evans, who is a colleague and co-worker at the institution.
Dr. Nussbaum, I want to learn about your early life. So tell me when and where you were born.
I was born in a displaced persons camp outside of Munich, Germany. In 1947, about 2 years after the war ended.
Tell me about this. Why were you there?
I was there because I chose to be where my mother was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were Polish Jews who survived the Holocaust, and when they were trying to make their way back to Poland, they found that they had nothing left in terms of property and family. So they joined a stream of refugees at that time, heading to either the States or to Israel. And they were at this refugee camp for about 2 years,
mm-hmm.
actually for 3 or 4 years now that I think of it. And I was born there. And I came to the state. We came to the States 2 years later in 1949. So I have no memory of it. I do have my birth certificate, but I have no memory of the of that time.
That's a remarkable story, and we could spend this entire interview just on that. But during the war, may I ask what happened to them during the war? Were they?
They were fortunate enough to, if you want to call it that, to be, when Poland was partitioned between Germany and Russia, they were on the Russian side and spent the war in labor camps as opposed to extermination camps.
Camps, right.
Which were tough enough by the descriptions that my father gave me. My mother didn't talk about it much, but my father did. I also had have an older sister who was at the time, a young girl.
Mm-hmm.
That was before I was born.
And did they meet at the camp? Were they married before?
No, they were married before.
Okay.
My parents were married in the 1920s.
Okay.
My parents were older. My father was born in 1902.
Uh-huh.
And when I was born, he was already 45 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And your sister, she...
My sister is here.
Here?
Yeah.
Okay.
She came along.
That's good.
And
she chose to come.
She is she's in business. She's 71 now,
mm-hmm.
but still running a business, a microwave type company that she and her husband ran together. They were sort of had a mom and pop business, and he passed away a couple of years back, but she has continued to do that. And her training is as a mathematician. She never got her PhD, but she had a master's in mathematics.
So they your parents came to the United States, and did they have a choice of where to go? United States or Israel, or
I think whatever the visa situation was at that time, the U.S. one came through first. My father had a sister who was a farmer in Israel, and a brother who had a business in New York, and the New York thing came through first. Actually, we lived in Connecticut. Initially with cousins of my mother, and when my father was able to get a job, we lived with them for about 6 months, I think, and when my father was able to get a job in the city, in New York City, we moved to Brooklyn.
And what did your parents do when they came and got settled?
Well, that's sort of a sad story, because my dad was My parents were quite well-to-do in Poland. My father and his father owned a masonry business, and they did quite well. They were solid middle-class type people, but they lost everything, and my father didn't speak any English when he came here, had no way of using those skills, or at least he wasn't and he was, like I said, he was older, and he ended up working in a grocery store mm-hmm. for until he retired at around 65.
Mm-hmm. And your mom?
My mom was a homemaker.
Homemaker.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And she, my dad lived to be, he died at the age of 70, so I was about 25 at that time. That was a you know, real loss for me. My mom, she lived to be 92.
Wow.
So she did quite well.
What were they like? Tell me about them as people. And
oh, they were, my father was very funny man. He could you know, he could make you crack up just by the way he would the glint in his eye before he told a joke or told a story would make you laugh even before you heard the end of it. And my mom was just a very well-liked, everyone loved my mom. She was a very well-liked, sweet lady who, you know, did whatever needed to be done. She called she had a nickname, she told me, when she was in Europe, of they called her the soldier because she was able to rise to whatever occasion.
Yeah.
She just plowed through whatever she needed
she
to
met
do.
Every challenge
right.
that came
right.
her way.
Right.
If you think about yourself and your sister, mathematician and physician, are there certain traits from your mom or your dad that you think you got that might, you know, might not have known because he was in the grocery business and she was a homemaker?
Right. Well, you know, I think we had a fairly tight family. By that I mean we had aunts and uncles. My father was one of nine, although four survived, but those were around us in our general area in Brooklyn. I had two aunts, one that lived in the same building, my father's sister, and you know, education and doing well in school and was considered a, you know, a must. I never felt that my parents pressured me directly, but I'm sure in retrospect that there was always that expectation that was there. You know, I didn't always have the best report cards, and I didn't get beat up about it, but I knew when I disappointed them. Mm. And
they had faith in you. They knew
yeah.
you could
and
do
I, and it. I remember, you know, a lot of people don't know what they're going to do early in life, but I knew I wanted to be a physician when I would go with my mom to the doctor, whether mm-hmm. it was for her or for me, and if I was tagging along or whether it was for me. I just was very cognizant of, you know, all the people that were there waiting for this one person to see them and to help them, and very aware of the respect my mother had for you know, our particular physician, and how she'd always talk so highly of him. And somewhere in there, I said to myself that that's what I want to do.
Wow.
So I knew by the time I was in high school, I already knew that I wanted to be a doctor.
That's really great. What is your best memory of childhood?
Oh, I guess you know, I grew up with my cousins and a couple of friends, and we were pretty close. So my best memories, really, I think, were of playing sports. You know, we fashioned our own games. There was no, if there was Little League, we didn't know about it.
Mm.
If there was, you know, team football, we didn't know about it. What we did was we played our own type of baseball and our own type of football in the streets, and stoop ball and box ball and Chinese box ball and all sorts of games that you sort of, that were part of, you know, city life in Brooklyn. And I, as opposed to a lot of people that I've spoken to over the years, I would have to say that I had a happy childhood, that I remember it being full of that kind of joyful activity. At the same time, I also remember always feeling that we did not have resources. My parents didn't. We didn't ever had a car. I was the first one in the family that ever had a car.
Wow.
So that was both good and bad. I kind of, compared to a lot of other people in our community, I felt that we were sort of one of the poorer families. I didn't get a bicycle until I was maybe 11 or 12 years old. And that was only after, you know, pestering my parents forever about that. So I did that part of my childhood I remember as being painful, and that is that I always felt that compared to friends and others that were not immigrants but that were, you know, established American families, that we did not have the resources.
I'm wondering, were there other people like yourself, though, children of immigrants? Were they part of your circle?
Yeah, well, again, my cousins.
Right, your cousins all came over. Okay.
Yeah, my cousins. And so you know, my cousins did very well. I have one cousin who is a very successful ophthalmologist in Brooklyn and a fundraiser for his community. I have a cousin who was the director of the National Holocaust Museum.
Really? In Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, yeah. Walter Reich is his name.
Oh,
he's
my goodness.
He's a writer, and he's a professor at George Washington. He lived downstairs. He's 3 years older than I am, and I followed him through school. And
that's one of the most amazing museums I've ever been in, I have to just share with you. That is transformative.
Yeah,
that's that means.
Well, he
so
was
much.
The director for several years, and before he moved on to his current position as a professor at George Washington, you know, my cousins are remarkable people. I have my other aunt, my father's other sister. One of her daughters. Was involved in an accident while out of the country where she became paraplegic and managed to raise, you know, three just wonderful children, and has been they live in New Jersey, and she, you know, has been honored many times, she and her husband, as being, you know, pillars of their communities. And this is a woman who could have just as easily thrown up her hands and given up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. All of these wonderful, successful, you know, in their own way, family members. If you had to distill, you know, the essence of what your family, not just your parents, but your aunts and uncles, what did they do so right that led you all to? Can you think about what that might be?
Well, again, I think, education was an important underpinning for all of us. You know, making something of yourself, making your parents and your family proud, and staying true to your family ideals. I think those were important parts of our upbringing. We never thought otherwise. You know, we did all of the major holidays, the Jewish holidays, and others. We shared.
Was religion a strong part of
it?
Your
was,
upbringing?
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually raised Orthodox, and my parents, all my cousins are Orthodox. We're probably my wife and I, in some sense, turned out to be the black sheep because we left the fold. But even so, we have very good relations with our family members. My sister is still Orthodox, but she and I get along quite well.
That's great.
Despite the fact that we haven't practiced in 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, was the understanding of a gradual, I suppose, understanding from childhood on of what your parents went through, was that part, was it a pressure on you at all? Or did you feel, my parents have been through so much, I really have to show them that. Or was that
I think some of my cousins felt that more than I did. I kind of say that as one of my regrets. I don't think I was as sensitive at the time, at least if I wasn't aware of it. I think as I got older, especially after my father died, I was much more aware of some of the things that I did not allow myself to feel or be in touch with at that time as I was growing up. But I knew that they had had real hardships, but didn't really understand that until I was an adult. I should have, but I didn't. To think about what would it be like for me in my 40s to have to go to another country where I don't speak a syllable of the language and start all over again with children in tow. And I don't know how these people were able to do that.
Did you speak Russian or Polish growing up?
No, my first language was actually Yiddish, which I still speak. I can speak, although not as fluently as I did when I was younger, because I don't have anyone to speak it with. My wife doesn't speak Yiddish, and God knows my children don't. But that was my first language. If my parents wanted to talk to each other without me understanding, they spoke Polish. They spoke a little German, but not very much.
Can you say something to me in Yiddish?
No.
No? Okay. Maybe by the end, you'll think of something. We only have a limited amount of time. I want to make sure that I get a lot of these things. Tell me about your wife and how you met.
My wife was the best friend of a girl I was going out with in high school, and as that relationship cooled off, the relationship with my future wife started to heat up, and we were high school sweethearts, and she's a year younger than I am. We went through college together, and we got married young, although at the time it was fairly commonplace, at least among the culture that I was in. I was 22 when we got married, and she was 21, and I was a first-year medical student at the time. And she completely straightened out my life. I was up I went to school in Syracuse for medical school, and she... My first couple of months there, it was as if I was a street person. That's what my apartment looked like. And and then she came in and just organized my life for me. I just don't mean the apartment. I mean, just everything seemed to make sense after that. And, and she's been that way ever since.
Wow.
She's, just an amazing woman. She's an artist who I am absolutely convinced is a unique talent. Her paintings are exceptional, and people that have seen them at the few shows that she's had have always commented on how, they could easily envision her work in a much bigger venue, but neither she nor I have ever quite known how to market her, and so she's remained... more of a local artist than I think she wants to be. She would like to. She also works in fabric and does some amazing things with fabric. She's a very talented person.
That's great. Let's talk about your children. When did you first find out that you would be a parent, and how did you feel?
I guess, I was in medical school. My daughter, Amy, was born the month that I graduated from medical school. And I have to say, my son is 17 and a half years to the day younger than she is. He was born later. Well, she was born on May 1st. He was born on November 1st. So it just turns out to be 17 and a half. And She came out a screaming redhead, and I'll always remember that. My wife did natural labor at that time, which she didn't do again. And it was just a transforming moment. I mean, a typical question that people ask at interviews is what's your most ecstatic moment in life? It has to be the birth of my children. I was there for both of them, and when my son was born, I could barely breathe. That's how ecstatic I was. Not that his birth was any more wonderful than my daughter's, but I was an older parent at that point in time, and you're just in a different place.
Absolutely. Yeah. How has being a parent changed you?
Well, especially being an older parent, I would say a lot of Advil and Bengay. you do everything for your children. I think, I'm not people who haven't had children either by choice or otherwise. Have a different kind of life, and I'm not saying one is better than the other by any means, but because you both gain and lose things when you have others that you're responsible for. There's a part of it that is actually frightening, and that is that I remember when my daughter was getting older, she was an adolescent, and I was beginning to, and she was starting to drive, and I was beginning to feel freer in terms of my own responsibilities to her and to myself, and then Zach came along, and suddenly I had to think about getting on an airplane again, as to not just my own mortality, but what that would mean for my youngster. It's like, in a sense, like being hostage, far outweighed by all the joys that they bring to your life. And for Amy, it was everything she did was joyful, and Zach, the sports was a big part of his upbringing, and I loved going to his games. As busy as I was, I always somehow managed to get to most of his games, which amazed him and amazed me. it was a priority for me.
And what do they both do now?
Amy is a internist. She's a physician. She lives in Palo Alto, California. She's married to John, who is a professor of economics at Stanford, and they have two kids, and they have a little girl, Madeline, and a little boy, Benjamin, and they have a third on the way, which is due in just a few weeks. Zachary is just finished his first year of college at University of Rochester, and he's interested in economics. He hasn't absolutely declared his major yet, but that seems to be the direction he's going. And Zachary is an absolutely amazing guitarist. I've played guitar since I was a teenager, but he blew by me years ago. If he wanted to, he could probably make music a career, but I'm not sure that that's something he wants to do.
Do you have any favorite stories about either one of them?
Favorite stories. I remember Amy when she was when she was at she went to Hopkins for which is a prep type school in New Haven, Connecticut, and when she was playing field hockey. And she wanted me to come to one of her games. And at the time, I was chair of medicine here at Griffin Hospital, and I was we had a medical executive committee meeting that day at around the time that her game was scheduled, and I said that I wouldn't be able to go. And the middle of the meeting, I get this outside page, and it turned out to be a neighbor of ours who said, Paul, don't get scared now, but Amy has apparently been hit by a hockey stick, and I can't find Estelle, which is my wife, and so I'm calling you. And I said, okay, I'll be right there. And I went over there, and I walked into the place where they told me she was, and I opened the door to this room in the athletic center, and there she was sitting in the corner on top of a desk with her T-shirt completely covered with blood, holding a ice pack to her nose and her face. And I looked at her, and my shoulders drooped, I remember, and she said to me, I told you I'd get you to come to my game.
She inherited that sense of humor.
Yeah, I guess so.
From your dad.
I guess so. So I always, we talk about it. We bring that up from time to time.
That's great. What are your dreams for your children? What do you hope for them?
Well, I hope that they can, appreciate the good things when the times are good. To borrow something or paraphrase something that I believe Albert Einstein said, that the important things in life are, truth, beauty, love, and I may be paraphrasing that. But I've actually told them those things, that and kindness, that I think they're both kind kids. They both have soft hearts, which is both good and bad, but I think for the most part good. And I've always tried to make it clear to them that the way they treat others is really the most important thing in life. And I hope that, I think if they do that, which I think they will do, they will get more out of life.
Let's talk a little bit about your work. You've already sort of told me about how you always thought you would be a physician and how you got into it. Tell me, a little bit about when you came to Griffin, if that's...
I came to Griffin, I did a fellowship in nephrology. I'm a nephrologist, a kidney doctor that deals with medical kidney disease, dialysis, things of that nature. I came to Connecticut in 1978 after I had completed 3 years at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and I looked all around the Northeast for a place to start a practice. I was interested in doing some in education as well. And Griffin was unique. It didn't have a nephrologist. It was near Yale. A lot of my friends and colleagues that I had worked with in the past had migrated in that area into New Haven. So I came here. And at the time, I wondered whether it was the right move because Griffin did not have a very good reputation at that time. It was a fairly dinky little hospital. There was nothing that I could point to that would say, this is a great quality place. And we spent a good number of years trying to figure out how to change that, not just as a perception, but as the reality. And it's been amazing to me over these past 30, 31 years that I've been here how Griffin has evolved into such a wonderful quality institution, in large part because of very visionary leadership by both our current administration as well as to some extent by previous administrations. And it's now an institution that is known internationally and that everybody who works here can be very proud of. Now when you say you work at Griffin Hospital, people stop and you can tell that they look at you with some degree of admiration, which was not the case 30 years ago. It's been a an incredible journey in that regard.
When you think of your personal contributions here, what are you most proud of? What do you think that you know, what are the highlights of what you've been able to contribute here?
That's a tough one. I mean, I've been in various leadership positions. Like I said, for 10 years I was the chairman of the Department of Medicine. Prior to that, I was chief of nephrology. I was very involved in the education program for many years, and I've been president of the medical staff for the last several years. I think what I try to bring to all those experiences has been, you know, a sense of fairness, a sense of community obligation, a sense of we're all in this together, and this is not one segment against the other, which is very commonplace in hospitals, especially among medical staff. And I think that really has been my best contribution, and that is I think I've been a voice of, in general, a voice of reason, and I have put teamwork as a major goal and method of achieving our goals.
Are there any particularly challenging cases that you remember? Anything that really maybe you surprised yourself or that are memorable for you?
Well, there. There've been many. There are some lessons that I have learned the hard way, as we all do. Part of my teaching of medical house staff has been to tell them about the importance of communicating with both the patient and patient's family. And in particular, that if you ever get into an argument with a family member or a patient, that you've lost already. Whether you're right or wrong on the facts of the situation, if you walk out of that room having fought with them, having major disagreements, and having raised voices or said things that are somewhat hurtful or belligerent, you never win. Whether you're right or wrong, you've lost. And that's an important thing to remember as these things unfold, as they always do. People are amazing in their variability of their temperaments and their perception of what's going on around them. And you're not going to agree with everybody, and they're not going to agree with you. And you're supposed to be helping them and taking care of them, and you're going to have to somehow learn to adjust your way of dealing with those situations in a way that doesn't alienate the folks you're trying to help. And that isn't always very easy. I'll give you one example of, this is going to sound a little cold-hearted, but it isn't. In the early years, my secretary kept a list of patients that she would not schedule two people on that list for me to see in the office on the same day, because they required a tremendous amount of energy on my part to deal with them. That's not to say that I didn't get along with them and that I didn't have a positive relationship with them, but they kind of sucked the life out of you. If you spent a half an hour with them, your day was done.
Yeah.
And we stopped keeping that list, but just on principle after a while. But that's what it can be like. If you get a couple of patients like that in one day, you pretty much ties you up for the day in terms of your emotions. I can remember, I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but I can remember one of them talking about ecstatic moments in one's life, one of which, like I said, was the birth of my children. One of those moments was when one of those patients on that list mentioned to me almost in passing that she was moving out of state. And I had a feeling of incredible joy and yet guilt that I felt that joy at the same time. But it was all I could do not to get up and do a jig in the room, because she had drained me so much for so many years with, you know, frequent phone calls, often asking the same things over and over again in different verbiage. And you know, I loved her very much, she was a challenge. But when she told me she was moving, it was difficult not to jump for joy. Ironically, she came back about a year later. So, she did move out west, and I came back east. But that's what it can be like. And to say otherwise, that every patient you can treat the exact same way is just not realistic. Yeah.
Can you tell me just briefly about one of the major events here was the anthrax case, just briefly about your role in that?
Oh, that was, I was seeing patients in the office, and my secretary handed me a note saying that I had a consultation to do in the intensive care unit, quote, anthrax, unquote. This is what she wrote on the note, and I said to her, sure, I'm sure that that's right, being convinced that somebody had made, this was during the major anthrax scare that we had a couple of years ago, after office hours, I went over to see the patient, and indeed, she did have kidney failure, which is why I was being asked to see her, but she did have anthrax, and it was one of those isolated cases of a woman locally here in Oxford who developed anthrax for reasons no one has ever clearly found out. But it was a case that incidentally was diagnosed correctly and appropriately, and efficiently by one of our infectious disease doctors here at the time, which I was very proud of, that she was able to do that.
Yeah.
But you know, that was that's not atypical for Griffin. We see some unusual things here. I just tell you a funny story. We had our doctor at the time, our chief of medicine, who's still our chief of medicine here, is Dr. Kenneth Dobular, and he was being interviewed nationally because of this was a case of national importance. And at the time, our program director in internal medicine, Dr. Amati, was traveling in I believe he was in Japan. And he told the story when he got back that he was sitting in his hotel room having a Kirin beer, and he was looking up at the TV, and there was his chief of medicine on CNN talking in basically Japanese because they were Dubbing it. And the way he told the story was how he looked down at his beer and wanted to be sure of what he was drinking. but it was one of these bizarre moments that he described. But that's how, you know, periodically Griffin has been internationally involved. And as it is with its model of care, the Plaintree model, which has gained international relevance and prominence, of which, you know, we're all very proud.
We just have a little bit of time. I want to ask you a couple of big questions, if I can. What do you think have been the most important lessons that you've learned in life? If there was something you wanted to impart, what would
this,
it be?
Can you give me that in a multiple choice? It's kind of the most important lessons in life.
Yeah. To your grandchildren, if you were to say to your grandchildren, this is what I want you to make sure you know.
I again will say that I think kindness is right up at the top. It's incredibly important to find the best in others, to look at for the best in others, and to be kind to others, because it's the golden rule, and I firmly believe in it. Being loved and loving somebody is crucial to have a fulfilling life, I think. And I would want them to know that. But I think it's something most people come to know in time. Some don't. And appreciating beauty in all its forms, whether it's in another person, whether it's in nature, whether it's in art, whether it's in anything, I think is extremely important and makes life worthwhile and makes life exciting. And going along with that is having a sense of wonder, mm-hmm. which I think is crucial to keep your mind alive and to make it all worthwhile.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you want to make sure that you have a chance to talk about?
You mean like my favorite color?
What's your favorite color, Doctor?
Is there anything you haven't asked me? No, I think we've pretty much covered it all. I think there is nothing more to be said.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.